But he was not well, as you know. It was difficult for my mother to take care of him. In other words, there was no simple way to make things better for me back then. Even if Daniel had stayed with us, those still would have been hard years. I wonder about this. She has said as much to me before, but I sometimes question whether she is being completely truthful. It meant a lot to me when you held me that night.
What else could I do?
You could have turned and walked back to the bedroom.
I could not do such a thing. It hurt me to see you like that.
You kissed my tears away, I said.
Yes,
she says. And later we held each other as we lay in bed. It was the first time in a long time.
Yes,
she says again. And things started to get better again.
It was time, she said.
I was tired of being sad. And you knew how much I still loved you.
Yes, she says.
I always knew that. In 1964, on our trip to New York, Ruth and I experienced a second honeymoon of sorts. It wasn't planned, nor did we do anything extraordinary. It was more akin to a daily celebration that we had somehow put the worst of the past behind us. We held hands as we toured the galleries and began to laugh again. Her smile, I still believe, had never been more contagious in its joy than it was that summer. It was also the summer of Andy Warhol. His art, so commercial and yet unique, didn't appeal to me. I found little interest in paintings of soup cans, nor did Ruth, but she was taken with Andy Warhol at their initial meeting. I think this was the only instance in which she bought something simply due to the force of the artist's personality. She knew intuitively that he would somehow be an artist who would define the 1960s, and we purchased 4 original prints. By then, his work had already become expensive. It's all relative, of course, especially when considering their value now. And afterward, we had no money left. After only a week up north, we returned to North Carolina and went to the Outer Banks, where we rented a cottage at the beach. Ruth wore a bikini that summer for the very first time, though she refused to wear it anywhere except on the back veranda, with towels draped over the railing to block others' sight lines. After our trip to the beach, we journeyed to Asheville, as always. I read her the letter I'd written as we stood by the lake, and the years continued to roll along. Lyndon Johnson was elected president, and the civil rights law was passed. The war in Vietnam picked up steam, while at home we heard much about the war on poverty. The Beatles were all the rage, and women entered the workforce in droves. Ruth and I were aware of all of it, but it was life inside our home that mattered most to us. We led our lives as we always had, both of us working and collecting art in the summers, having breakfast in the kitchen, and sharing stories over dinner. We bought paintings by Victor Vassarelli and Arnold Schmidt, Frank Stella and Ellsworth Kelly. We appreciated the work of Julian Stanchak and Richard Anuskevich, and bought paintings by them as well. And I will never forget Ruth's expression as she picked out every one. It was around that time that we began to make use of our camera. Until that point, strangely, it had never been a priority for us. And in the long span of our lives, we filled only 4 albums. But it is enough for me to turn the pages and watch as Ruth and I slowly grow older. There is a photo Ruth took of me on my 50th birthday in 1970, and another of her in 1972, when she celebrated the same milestone. In 1973, we rented the first of the storage units to house part of our collection, and in 1975, Ruth and I boarded the QE2 and sailed to England.
Even then, I couldn't imagine flying. We spent 3 days in London and another 2 days in Paris before boarding a train to Vienna, where we spent the next 2 weeks. For Ruth, it was both nostalgic and painful to return to the city she had once called home. Though I could usually discern what she was feeling, I spent much of that time wondering what to say. In 1976, Jimmy Carter was elected president over Gerald Ford, who'd replaced Richard Nixon. The economy was in the dumps, and there were long lines at the gas stations. Yet Ruth and I hardly heeded these developments as we fell in love with a new movement in art called Lyrical Abstractionism, which had its roots in both Pollock and Rothko. In that year, it was the year Ruth finally stopped coloring her hair, we celebrated our 30th anniversary. Though it cost a small fortune and I had to take out a loan to do so, I presented her with the only paintings I ever bought on my own. Two small Picassos, one from the Blue Period and another from the Rose. That night, she hung them in the bedroom. And after making love, we lay in the bed, staring at them for hours. In 1977, with business at the shop nearly at a standstill, I began to build birdhouses in my spare time from kits I purchased at the hobby shop. This phase did not last long, maybe 3 or 4 years, but my hands remained clumsy, and I eventually gave it up, just as the Reagan era began. Though the news informed me that debt wasn't a problem, I paid off the loan I'd used to buy the Picassos anyway. Ruth sprained her ankle and spent a month on crutches. In 1985, I sold the shop and started collecting Social Security. In 1987, after 40 years in the classroom, Ruth did the same. The school and the district threw a party in her honor. During her career, she had been named Teacher of the Year 3 times, and in that time, my hair went from black to gray and then to white, thinning with every passing year. The lines on our faces grew deeper, and both of us realized that we could no longer see near or far without glasses. In 1990, I turned 70, and in 1996, on our 50th anniversary, I presented Ruth with the longest letter I'd ever written. She read it aloud, and when she did, I realized I could barely hear her. 2 weeks later, I would be fitted with a hearing aid. But I accepted this with equanimity. It was time. I was growing old. Though Ruth and I never again experienced darkness in our marriage the way we had after Daniel disappeared, things were not always easy. Her father died in 1966, and 2 years later, her mother died from a stroke. In the 1970s, Ruth found a lump in her breast, and until it was biopsied and found negative, she thought she might have cancer. My parents passed away within a year of each other in the late 1980s, and Ruth and I stood over each of their graves, sobered by the realization that we were the last survivors in either of our families. I could not foresee the future. But you can do such things. I do not know what I expected in the years we still had left together. I assumed we would continue just as we always had, for it was the only life I'd ever known. Maybe less travel. The trips and the walking were getting hard for us. But other than that, no difference at all. We had no kids or grandkids we needed to visit. No urge to travel abroad again. Instead, Ruth devoted more time to the garden, and I began to feed the pigeons. We began to take vitamins, and neither of us had much of an appetite. Looking back, I suppose I should have given more thought to the fact that by our golden anniversary, Ruth had already outlived both her parents. But I was too afraid to consider the implications. I couldn't imagine a life without her, nor did I want one. But God had other plans. In 1998, like her mother, Ruth had a stroke, one that weakened the left side of her body. Though she was still able to get around the house, our collecting days were at an end, and we never again purchased another piece of art. 2 years later, on a cold spring morning as we sat in the kitchen, she trailed off in mid-sentence, unable to complete her thought. And I knew she'd had another stroke. She spent 3 days in the hospital undergoing tests, and though she came back home, we would never again have a conversation in which the words flowed freely. The left side of her face lost even more movement, and she began to forget the most common of words. This upset Ruth more than it did me. To my eyes, she remained as beautiful as she'd been on the day I'd first seen her. I was certainly no longer the man I once had been. My face had become wrinkled and thin, and whenever I looked in the mirror, the size of my ears never ceased to astonish me. Our routines become even simpler, one day simply drifting to the next. I would make her breakfast in the morning, and we would eat together as we browsed the newspaper. After breakfast, we would sit in the yard and feed the pigeons. We napped in the late morning, and would spend the rest of the day reading or listening to music, or going to the grocery store. Once a week, I would drive into the beauty salon where a hairdresser would wash and style her hair, something that I knew would make her happy. And then, when August came around, I would spend hours at my desk crafting a letter for my wife, and I'd drive the two of us to Black Mountain on our anniversary, where we'd stand by the lake, just as we always had, while she read the words I'd written. By that point, our adventures were long behind us. But for me, it was more than enough, for the longest ride continued. Even then, as we lay in bed, I would hold Ruth close, grateful for the blessing of this life, this woman. In those moments, I would selfishly pray that I would die first, for even then I could sense the inevitable. In the spring of 2002, a week after the azaleas in the yard had begun to bloom in full, we spent our morning as we always had, and in the afternoon we made plans to go out to dinner. It was something we seldom did, but both of us were in the mood, and I remember calling the restaurant to make an early reservation. In the afternoon, we went for a walk. Not long, just to the end of the block and back, though there was a brisk edge to the air. Ruth did not seem to notice. We spoke briefly to one of our neighbors, not the angry man who cut down the tree, and after we returned home, we settled into what was, until that point, a relatively ordinary day. Ruth said nothing to me about having a headache, but in the early evening, before we'd made dinner, she slowly made her way to the bedroom. I thought nothing of it at the time. I was reading in the easy chair, must have dozed off for a few minutes. When I woke, Ruth still had not come back, and I called for her. She did not answer, and I rose from my chair. I called for her again as I made my way down the hallway. When I saw her crumple near the bed, I felt my heart jump in my chest. She'd had another stroke, I immediately thought. But it was worse. And as I tried to breathe life back into her, I could feel my soul begin to wither. The paramedics arrived a few minutes later. I heard them first knocking and then pounding at the door. By then I was holding Ruth in my arms, and I did not want to let go. I heard them enter and call out. I called back, and they rushed to the bedroom where they found an old man holding the woman he'd always loved. They were kind and soft-spoken, as one of them helped me to my feet while the other began to administer to Ruth. I begged them to help her, trying to elicit promises that she was going to be all right. They put her on oxygen and loaded her onto the stretcher, allowing me to sit in the ambulance as Ruth was rushed to the hospital. When the doctor came out to speak with me in the waiting room, he was gentle. He held my arm as we walked down the corridor. The tiles were gray and the fluorescent lights made my eyes hurt. I asked if my wife was all right. I asked when I would be allowed to see her. But he didn't answer. Instead, he led me to an empty patient room and closed the door behind him. His expression was serious, and when he cast his eyes toward the floor, I knew exactly what he was going to say.
"I'm sorry to have to tell you this, Mr. Levinson, but there was nothing we could do." At these words, I gripped a nearby bed rail to keep from falling. The room seemed to close in as the doctor went on, my vision telescoping until I could see nothing but his face. His words sounded tinny and made no sense, but it did not matter. His expression was plain. I'd been too late. Ruth, my sweet Ruth, had died on the floor while I dozed in the other room. I do not remember leaving the hospital, and the next few days are hazy. My attorney, Howie Sanders, a dear friend to both Ruth and me, helped with the funeral arrangements, a small private service. Afterward, the candles were lit, cushions were spread through the house, and I sat Shiva for a week. People came and went, people we had known over the years. Neighbors, including the man who'd cut down the maple tree, customers from the shop, 3 gallery owners from New York, 6 artists. Women from the synagogue came every day to cook and clean. And on each of those days I found myself wishing that I would wake from the nightmare that my life had just become. But gradually the people drifted away, until no one was left at all. There was no one to call, no one to talk to, and the house descended into silence. I did not know how to live that kind of life, and time became merciless. Days crept by slowly. I could not concentrate. I would read the newspaper and remember nothing at all. I would sit for hours before realizing that I'd left the radio on in the background. Even the birds did nothing to cheer me. I would stare at them and think to myself that Ruth should have been sitting beside me, our hands brushing as we reached into the bag for birdseed. Nothing made any sense, nor did I want to make sense of it. My days were spent in the quiet agony of heartbreak. Evenings were no better. Late at night, as I lay in the half-empty bed, unable to sleep, I would feel the dampness trickling off my cheeks. I'd wipe my eyes and be struck anew by the finality of Ruth's absence.
Luke. It all went back to the ride on Big Ugly Critter. The one he'd had nightmares about, the one that had kept him away from the arena for 18 months. He'd told Sophia about the ride and a bit about the injuries he'd suffered. But he hadn't told her everything. As he stood in the barn after his mother had left, Luke leaned against the mechanical bull, reliving the past he'd tried hard to forget. It was 8 days before he'd even known what had happened. Although he knew he had been hurt and, after some prompting, could vaguely remember the ride, he'd had no idea how close he'd come to dying. He'd had no idea that in addition to fracturing his skull, the bull had cracked his C1 vertebra and that his brain had swelled with blood. He hadn't told Sophia that they didn't reset the bones in his face for almost a month for fear of causing additional trauma. Nor had he mentioned that the doctors had returned to his bedside to tell him that he'd never completely recover from the head injury, and that in a section of his skull, there was now a small titanium plate. The doctors told him that another similar impact to his head, with or without a helmet, would most likely be enough to kill him. The plate they had grafted onto his shattered skull was too close to the brainstem to adequately protect him. After that first meeting with the doctors, he'd had fewer questions than anyone anticipated. He'd decided right then to give up bull riding, and he'd told everyone as much. He knew he'd missed the rodeo and that he'd probably wonder forever what it would have felt like to win the championship. But he'd never entertained a death wish, and at the time, he'd thought he still had plenty of money in the bank. And he had, but it wasn't enough. His mom had offered up the ranch as collateral for the loan she'd taken out to cover his monstrous medical bills. Though she'd told him repeatedly that she didn't care about the fate of the ranch, he knew that deep down she did. The ranch was her life. It was all she knew, and everything she'd done since the accident had confirmed her feelings. In the past year, she'd worked herself to the point of exhaustion in an attempt to forestall the inevitable. She could say whatever she wanted, but he knew the truth. He could save the ranch. No, he couldn't earn enough in the next year, or even 3 years, to pay off the loan. But he was a good enough rider to earn enough to meet the payments and then some, even if he rode only on the little tour. He admired his mom's efforts with the Christmas trees and the pumpkins and expanding the herd, but both of them knew it wasn't going to be enough. He'd heard enough about the cost of fixing this or that to know that things were tight even in the best of times. So what was he supposed to do? He had to either pretend that everything was going to work out, which wasn't possible, or find a way to fix the problem. And he knew exactly how to fix the problem. All he had to do was ride well. But even if he rode well, he still might die. Luke understood the risks. That was the reason his hands shook every time he prepared to ride. It wasn't that he was rusty or that he was plagued with ordinary nerves. It was the fact that when he used the suicide wrap to hold on, a part of him wondered if this would be his last ride. It wasn't possible to ride successfully with that kind of fear. Unless, of course, there was something greater at stake, and for him, it came down to the ranch, and his mom. She wasn't going to lose the ranch because of him. He shook his head. He didn't want to think about these things. It was hard enough to find the confidence he knew he needed to last and win over the course of a season. The one thing that you didn't want to think about was not being able to ride, or dying in the process. He hadn't been lying to the doctor when he said that he was ready to quit. He knew what a life of riding could do to a man. He'd watched his father wince and struggle in the mornings, and he'd felt the same pains himself. He'd lived through all the training, and he'd given it his best, but it hadn't worked out. And 18 months ago, he'd been okay with that. But right now, standing beside the mechanical bull, he knew that he had no choice. He pulled on his glove, then he took a deep breath and climbed onto the bull. Hanging off the horn was the control, and he took it in his free hand. But maybe because the season was getting close, or maybe because he hadn't told the complete truth to Sophia, he couldn't press the button. Not yet, anyway. He reminded himself that he knew what might happen, and he tried to convince himself he was ready. He was ready to ride. He was preparing to ride no matter what might happen. He was a bull rider. He'd done it for as long as he could remember, and he would do it again. He'd ride because he was good at riding, and then all their problems would be solved. Except that if he landed wrong, he might die. All at once, his hands began to tremble. But steeling himself, he finally pressed the button anyway. On her way back from New Jersey, Sophia made a detour to the ranch before returning to campus. Luke was expecting her, and had tidied up both the house and the porch in anticipation. It was dark when her car pulled to a stop in front of his house. He bounded down the porch steps to meet her, wondering if anything had changed since he'd last seen her. Those worries evaporated as soon as she stepped out of her car and rushed toward him. He caught her as she jumped, feeling her legs wrap around him. As they held each other, he reveled in how good she felt, certain again of how much she meant to him, wondering what the future would hold. They made love that evening, but Sophia couldn't stay the night. The new semester was beginning, and she had an early class. Once her taillights vanished up the drive, Luke turned and walked toward the barn for yet another practice session. He wasn't in the mood, but with the first event in less than 2 weeks, he reminded himself of how much more he had to do. On his way to the barn, he made the decision to keep the practice shorter than usual, no more than an hour. He was tired and it was cold, and he missed Sophia's presence already. Inside the barn, he went through a quick warm-up to get the blood flowing, then hopped on the bull. While rebuilding the bull, his dad had modified it to make the ride more intense at top speeds, and had rigged the control switch so that Luke could hold it in his free hand. Out of habit, he kept his hand clenched in a half fist even when riding live bulls, though to this point no one had ever asked why, or probably even noticed. When he was ready, he started the machine at a low-medium speed, again just enough to loosen up. He then rode once on medium and once on medium-high. In his practice sessions, he rode in 16-second increments, exactly double the time he'd need to ride in the arena. His dad had calibrated the machine for these longer rides, saying that it would make the live rides easier by comparison. And maybe it did. But it was twice as hard on the body. After each ride, he'd take a break to recover, and he took a longer break after every three. Usually in those moments, his mind was blank, but tonight he found himself flashing back to his ride on Big Ugly Critter. He wasn't sure why the images kept flooding his mind, but he couldn't stop them, and he felt his nerves jangle when his gaze fell on the mechanical bull. It was time for the real rides, the ones on high speed. His dad had calibrated 50 different rides to occur in a random sequence, so Luke would never know what to expect. Over the years, it had served him well, but right now he wished he knew exactly what was coming. When the muscles in his hand and forearm had recovered, he trudged back to the mechanical bull and climbed up. He rode three times, then three more, and three more after that. Of those nine, he made it to the end of the cycle seven times. Counting the recovery time, he'd been practicing for more than 45 minutes. He decided then to do three more sets of three and call it a night. He didn't make it. In the second ride of the second set, he felt the ride getting away from him. In that instant, he wasn't unduly alarmed. He'd been thrown a million times, and unlike the arena, the area surrounding the bull was lined with foam padding. Even while in the air, he hadn't been afraid, and he shifted, trying to land the way he wanted to in the arena, either on his feet or on all fours. He managed to land on his feet, and the foam absorbed the impact as it usually did. But for some reason, the landing left him off balance, and he found himself stumbling, instinctively trying to stay upright instead of simply falling. He took three quick steps as he fell forward, his upper body stretching past the foam flooring, and slammed his forehead against the hard-packed ground. His brain chimed like a thumbed guitar string. Slices of golden light shimmered as he tried to focus. The room began to spin, blotting to darkness and then brightening again. The pain started, sharp at first and then sharper, fuller, slowly rounding into agony. It took him a minute to summon the strength to stagger to his feet, holding on to the old tractor to stay upright. Fear raced through his system as he carefully examined the bump on his forehead with his fingers. It was swollen and tender, but as he felt around, he convinced himself that there was no further damage. He hadn't cracked anything, he was sure of it. The other parts of his head were fine as far as he could tell. Standing straight, he took a deep breath and started gingerly for the doors. Outside the door, his stomach abruptly turned and he doubled over. The dizziness came back, and he vomited into the dirt. Only once, but it was enough to concern him. He'd vomited after receiving previous concussions, and he figured he had one again. He didn't need to go to the doctor to know that he would be told not to practice for a week, maybe longer. Or, more accurately, he would be warned never to ride again. He was okay, though. It was a close call. Too close. But he'd survived. He'd take a few days off regardless of the approaching season, and as he limped back to his house, he tried to put a positive spin on it. He'd been practicing hard, and a break might do him good. When he came back, he'd probably be stronger than ever. But despite his attempts to reassure himself, he couldn't shake the feeling of dread that dogged his every step. And what was he going to tell Sophia? 2 days later, he still wasn't sure. He went to visit her at Wake, and as they walked the campus byways in the late hours of the night, Luke kept his hat on to hide the bruising on his forehead. He considered telling her about the accident, but was afraid of the questions she would ask and where they would lead. Questions he had no answers to. Finally, when she asked him why he was so quiet, he pleaded exhaustion over the long hours at the ranch. Truthfully enough, as his mother had decided to bring the cattle to market in advance of bull riding season, and they'd spent a couple of grueling days roping and herding the cattle onto trucks. But by then, he suspected that Sophia knew him well enough to sense that he wasn't himself. When she showed up at the ranch the following weekend wearing the hat he'd bought her and a thick down jacket, She seemed to be evaluating him as they readied the horses, though she said nothing at the time. Instead, they made the same ride they had on their first day together, through the stands of trees toward the river. Finally, she turned toward him. "Okay, enough of this," she announced. "I want to know what's bothering you. You've been off all week long."
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm still a little tired."
The bright sunlight drove knife blades into his skull, aggravating the constant headache he'd had since he'd been thrown. "I've seen you tired before. It's something else, but I can't help if I don't know what it is."
"I'm just thinking about next weekend. You know, first event of the year and all."
"In Florida?" He nodded.
"Pensacola."
"I've heard it's pretty there. White sand beaches?"
"Probably. Not that I'll see any of them. I'll drive back after the event on Saturday."
He thought back to his practice yesterday, his first since the accident. It had gone pretty well. His balance seemed unaffected, but the pounding in his head forced him to quit after 40 minutes. "It'll be late."
"This one's in the afternoon. I should be back around 2 or so."
"So I can see you on Sunday, then?" He tapped his hand against his thigh.
"If you come out here, but I'll probably be wiped out."
She squinted at him from under the brim of her hat. "Gee, don't sound so excited about it."
"I want to see you. I just don't want you to feel like you have to come over."
"Are you going to come to campus instead? Do you want to hang out at the sorority house?"
"Not particularly."
"Then would you like to meet somewhere else?"
"Dinner with my mom, remember?"
"Then I'll come here." She waited for a response, growing frustrated when he said nothing at all. In time, she turned in her saddle to face him. "What's gotten into you? It's like you're mad at me." It was the perfect opportunity to tell her everything. He tried to find the words, but he didn't know how to begin.
"I've been meaning to tell you that I could die if I keep riding."
"I'm not mad at you," he hedged.
"I'm just thinking about the season ahead and what I have to do."
"Right now?" She sounded doubtful.
"I think about it all the time, and I'll be thinking about it through the whole season. And just so you know, I'll be traveling a lot starting next weekend."
"I know," she said with unusual sharpness. "You told me."
"When the tour heads west, I might not even make it home most weeks until late Sunday night."
"So what you're saying is that you're not going to be seeing me as often, and when we are together, you'll be distracted?"
"Maybe,"
he shrugged.
"Probably."
"That's no fun."
"What else can I do?"
"How about this? Try not to think about your event next weekend right now. Let's just try to enjoy ourselves today, okay? Since you're going to be traveling? Since I'm not going to see you as much? It might be our last full day together for a while." He shook his head.
"It's not like that."
"What's not like that?"
"I can't just ignore what's coming," he said, his voice rising. "My life isn't like yours. It's not about going to classes and hanging out on the quad and gossiping with Marcia. I live in the real world. I have responsibilities."
He heard her gasp, but pressed on, growing more righteous with every word. "My job is dangerous. I'm rusty, and I know I should have practiced more this past week. But I have to do well starting next weekend no matter what, or my mom and I are going to lose everything. So of course I'm going to think about it, and yes, I'm going to be distracted." She blinked, taken aback by his tirade. "Wow, someone's in a bad mood today."
"I'm not in a bad mood," he snapped.
"You could have fooled me."
"I don't know what you want me to say."
For the first time, her expression hardened, and he heard her struggling to keep her voice steady. "You could have said that you wanted to see me on Sunday, even if you were tired. You could have said that even though you might be distracted, that I shouldn't take it personally. You could have apologized and said, 'You're right, Sophia, let's just enjoy today.' But instead, you tell me that what you do, in the real world, isn't like going to college."
"College isn't the real world."
"Don't you think I know that?" she cried.
"Then why are you so mad that I said it?"
he countered. She tugged the reins, forcing Demon to a halt.
"Are you kidding?"
she demanded.
"Because you're acting like a jerk. Because you're implying that you have responsibilities, but I don't. Can you even hear yourself?"
"I was just trying to answer your question."
"By insulting me?"
"I wasn't insulting you."
"But you still think that what you do is more important than what I do?"
"It is more important."
"To you and your mom," she shouted. Believe it or not, my family is important to me, too. My parents are important. Getting an education is important. And yes, I do have responsibilities, and I feel pressure to be successful just like you do. I have dreams, too.
Sophia.
What? Now you're ready to be civil? Well, you know what? Don't bother. Because the reality is that I drove up here to spend time with you, and all you're doing is trying to pick a fight.
I'm not trying to pick a fight, he mumbled.
But she wasn't hearing him.
Why are you doing this? She demanded. Why are you acting like this? What's going on with you?
He didn't answer. He didn't know what to say, and Sophia watched him, waiting, before shaking her head in disappointment. With that, she jerked the reins and turned demon, prodding him into a canter. As she disappeared in the direction of the stables, Luke sat alone amid the trees, wondering why he couldn't find the courage to tell her the truth. 22. Sophia.
So you just rode off and left him? Marcia asked.
I didn't know what else to do, Sophia replied, propping her chin in her hands. Marcia sat beside her as she lay on her bed.
By then I was so angry I could barely look at him.
I guess I'd be angry too, Marcia said, sounding just a bit too sympathetic.
I mean, we both know that art history majors are absolutely critical to the modern functioning of society. If that's not a serious responsibility, I don't know what is.
Sophia scowled at her.
Shut up.
Marcia ignored the comment.
Especially if they've yet to land a job that actually pays anything.
Didn't I just say shut up?
I'm just teasing you, Marcia said, nudging her with her elbow.
Yeah, well, I'm not in the mood, okay?
Oh, hush. I don't mean anything by it. I'm just happy you're here. I had already resigned myself to the fact that I'd be alone all day, and most of the night, too. I'm trying to talk to you.
I know. I've missed our talks. We haven't had one in ages.
And we're not going to have any more if you keep this up. You're making this a lot harder than you need to.
What do you want me to do?
I want you to listen.
I want you to help me figure this out.
I am listening, she said. I heard everything you said.
And?
Well, frankly, I'm just glad you finally had an argument. It's about time. I'm of the opinion that it's not a meaningful relationship until you have a real argument. Up until then, it's just a honeymoon. After all, you don't know how strong something is until you actually test it.
She winked.
I read that in a fortune cookie once.
Fortune cookie?
It's still true. And it's good for you. Because once you two get past this, you'll be stronger as a couple. And the makeup sex is always great.
Sophia made a face.
Is it always about sex with you?
Not always, but with Luke? She broke into a lascivious grin.
If I were you, I'd be trying to get past this as soon as possible.
That is one good-looking man.
Stop trying to change the subject. You need to help me figure this out. What do you think I've been doing?
Trying your best to irritate me? Marcia offered an earnest expression.
You know what I think? She asked. Based on what you told me? I think he's nervous about what's going to happen between you two. He's going to be traveling most weekends, and before you know it, you'll have graduated and he thinks you're not going to stick around. So he's probably beginning to distance himself.
Maybe, Sophia thought.
There was some truth there, but... It's more than that. She said. He's never been like this before. Something else is going on. Is there anything you haven't told me?
He might lose the ranch.
But she hadn't told Marcia that, nor would she. Luke had confided in her, and she wouldn't violate his trust. I know he's feeling a lot of pressure, she said instead. He wants to ride well. He's nervous.
Well, there's your answer, Marcia said. He's nervous and under pressure, and you kept telling him not to think about it. So he got a little defensive and lashed out because in his mind, you're indifferent to what he's going through.
Maybe, Sophia thought. Trust me, Marcia went on. He's probably regretting it already. And I'll bet he'll be calling you to apologize any minute now.
He didn't call. Not that night, or the next, or even the next. On Tuesday, Sophia spent most of the day alternately checking her phone to see if he'd texted and wondering whether she should call him. Though she attended classes and took notes, she was hard-pressed to recall anything her professors had said. Between classes, she would walk from one building to the next, reviewing Marcia's words, acknowledging that they made sense. Yet she couldn't escape the memory of Luke's, what, anger? Hostility? She wasn't sure if those were the right words, but she definitely felt as though he'd been trying to drive her away. Why? After everything had been so easy and comfortable for so long, had everything so quickly gone wrong? There was a lot that didn't add up. She should just pick up the phone and get to the bottom of all this, she decided. Depending on Luke's tone, she'd know almost immediately whether she was overreacting. She reached into her purse and pulled out her phone, but just as she was about to dial, she happened to look across the quad, noticing the familiar ebb and flow of life on campus. People carrying backpacks, a student riding his bike to who knew where, a college tour that had stopped near the administration building, and in the distance, beneath a tree, a couple facing each other. There was nothing unusual about any of it, but for whatever reason, something in the scene caught her attention and she lowered the phone. She found herself zeroing in on the couple. They were laughing, heads close together, the girl's hand caressing the boy's arm. Even from a distance, their chemistry crackled. She could almost feel it. But then again, she knew them both. What she was seeing was definitely more than a close friendship, a realization confirmed as soon as they kissed. Sophia couldn't look away, every muscle tensing at once. As far as she knew, he hadn't been to the house, nor had she heard their names mentioned together, which was almost impossible on a campus devoid of secrets, which meant that both of them had been trying to keep it secret until now, not only from her, but from everyone. But Marcia and Brian? Her roommate wouldn't do that to her, would she? Especially knowing what Brian had done to her? Yet in hindsight, it struck her that Marcia had mentioned him several times in recent weeks, and hadn't she admitted that she still talked to him? What had Marcia said about Brian, even while he was still stalking her? He's funny and good-looking and rich. What's not to like? Not to mention that he'd had a thing for her, as Marcia liked to point out, before Sophia came along. Sophia knew it shouldn't matter. She wanted nothing to do with Brian, and it had been over for a long time. Marcia could have him if she wanted. But when Marcia lifted her gaze in Sophia's direction, Sophia inexplicably felt tears spring to her eyes.
"I was going to tell you," Marcia said, uncharacteristically shamefaced.
They were back in their room, and Sophia stood near the window with her arms crossed. It was everything she could do to keep her voice steady. "How long have you been seeing him?"
"Not long," Marcia said. "He visited me at home over Christmas break, and why him? You remember how much he hurt me, right?"
Sophia's voice started to crack.
"You're supposed to be my best friend." "I didn't plan for it to happen," Marcia pleaded.
"But it did.
You were gone every weekend, and I'd see him at parties. We'd end up talking, usually about you."
"So you're saying this is my fault?"
"No," Marcia said. "It's no one's fault. I didn't mean for it to happen. But the more we talked and really got to know each other..."
Sophia tuned out the rest of Marcia's explanation, the knots in her stomach tight enough to make her wince. When the room fell silent, she tried to keep her voice steady.
"You should have told me."
"I did. I mentioned that we were talking, and I hinted that we were friends. That's all there was until a few weeks ago, I swear."
Sophia turned, facing her best friend and hating her at the same moment.
"This is just wrong on so many levels."
"I thought you were over him," Marcia mumbled.
Sophia's expression was livid.
"I am over him. I don't want anything to do with him. This is about us, you and me. You're sleeping with my ex-boyfriend."
She ran a hand through her hair.
"Marcia, friends don't do this to each other. How can you even begin to justify this?"
"I'm still your friend," Marcia offered, her tone soft. "It's not like I'm going to be bringing him up to the room when you're here."
Sophia could barely register what she was hearing.
"He's going to cheat on you, you know. Just like he cheated on me."
Marcia shook her head vehemently.
"He's changed. I know you won't believe that, but he has."
At this, Sophia knew she had to leave. She strode toward the door, grabbing her purse from the desk on the way out. At the door, she turned around.
Brian hasn't changed, she said with utter certainty. I can promise you that.
Habit and desperation led her back to the ranch. As always, Luke stepped onto the porch just as she was getting out of the car. Even from a distance, he seemed to know something was wrong, and despite the fact that she hadn't heard from him in days, he walked toward her with arms opened wide. Sophia went into them, and for a long time, he simply held her as she cried.
I still don't know what to do, she said, leaning back into Luke's chest. It's not like I can stop her from going out with him.
Luke was holding her close on the couch, both of them staring into the fire. He had let her ramble on for hours, agreeing with her from time to time, but mostly soothing her with his silent, comforting presence.
No, he agreed. You probably can't.
But what am I supposed to do when we're together? Pretend that it's not happening?
That would probably be best, since she's your roommate.
She's going to get hurt, Sophia said for the 100th time.
Probably.
Everyone in the house is going to be talking about it. Every time they see me, they're going to either whisper or snicker or act way too concerned, and I'm going to spend the rest of the semester dealing with it.
Probably.
She was quiet for a moment. Are you going to agree with everything I say?
Probably,
he answered, eliciting a laugh.
I'm just glad you aren't still mad at me.
I'm sorry about that, he said. And you were right to call me on it. You caught me on a bad day and I took it out on you. I was wrong to do that.
Everyone's entitled to a bad day.
He squeezed her tighter without saying anything. Only later did it occur to her that he never did tell her what had really been bothering him that day. After spending the night at the ranch, Sophia returned to the sorority house and took a deep breath before stepping into her room. She still wasn't ready to talk to Marcia, but a quick survey told her that she need not have worried about it. Marcia wasn't in the room, nor had her bed been slept in. She'd spent the night with Brian. 23. Luke. When Luke left for Pensacola a few days later, he did so with the uncomfortable knowledge that he hadn't practiced enough. The relentless, throbbing headache made thinking difficult and practice impossible. He told himself that if he could just survive these preliminaries in decent standing, he'd have a chance to fully recuperate in time for the next event. He knew nothing at all about stir-crazy, the first bull he drew in Pensacola. He hadn't slept well after the long drive, and his hands had begun to shake again. Though his headache was slightly diminished, he could still feel the thrumming between his ears, a vibration that felt like a living thing. He recognized only a handful of the riders, and half of the rest struck him as barely old enough to drive. All of them fiddled, trying to keep their nerves in check, all clinging to the same dream. Win or place, earn money and points, and whatever you do, don't get hurt so bad that you can't ride the following week. As he'd done in McLeansville, Luke stayed near his truck, preferring to be alone. He could still hear the crowd from the parking lot, and when he heard the roar go up, followed a few seconds later by the announcer barking, "That's the way it goes sometimes," he knew the rider had been thrown. He was scheduled to ride 14th, and even though the rides were measured in seconds, there was usually a break of a few minutes between competitors. He figured he'd go over in 15 minutes, if only to keep his nerves in check. He didn't want to be here. The thought came to him with unexpected clarity, even though deep down he'd known it all along. The undeniable conviction made him feel like the ground had just shifted under his feet. He wasn't ready for this. And maybe, just maybe, he'd never be ready. 15 minutes later, however, he began a slow trek to the arena. More than anything, it was the smell that enabled him to continue. It was familiar, triggering responses that had grown automatic over the years. The world compressed. He tuned out the sound of the crowd and the announcer, focusing his attention on the young handlers who were helping him get ready. Ropes were tightened. He worked the wrap until it felt exactly right in his hand. He centered himself on the bull. He waited for a split second, making sure everything was right, then nodded to the gate man.
Let's go.
Stir Crazy came out with a weak buck and then a second before twisting hard to the right, all four legs off the ground. But Luke had been ready and stayed low in his seat, keeping his balance as stir-crazy bucked two more times and then began to spin. Luke adjusted instinctively throughout all of it, and as soon as the buzzer sounded, he reached down with his free hand and undid the wrap. He jumped off, landing on both feet, and ran to the arena fence. He was out of harm's way before the bull had stopped bucking. The crowd continued to cheer, and the announcer reminded them that he'd once placed third in the world standings. He removed his hat and waved it at the crowd before turning around and hiking back to his truck. On the walk, his headache returned with punishing force. Ride number two was a bull named Candyland. Luke was in fourth place in the standings. Again, he went through the motions on autopilot, the world compressed to the narrowest of frames. Meaner bull this time, more showy. During the ride, he heard the crowd roar its approval. He rode successfully and again escaped the arena while the bull threw a temper tantrum. His score on that ride moved him into second place. He spent the next hour sitting behind the wheel of his truck, his head throbbing with every heartbeat. He supplemented a handful of ibuprofen with Tylenol, but it did little to blunt the pain. He wondered if his brain was swelling, and tried not to think about what would happen if he got thrown. With his last ride, he found himself in a position to win. Earlier, though, one of the other finalists had finished with the highest score of the day. In the chute, he was no longer nervous. Not because he'd experienced a burst of hidden confidence, but because the agony and exhaustion had left him too tired to care one way or the other. He just wanted to get it over with. Whatever happened, happened. When he was ready, the chute gate swung open. It was a good bull, though not as tricky as the second one had been. More challenging than the first, though, and his score reflected that. The winner would be decided by the leader's performance on his final ride. But the leader of the first two rounds lost his balance early on with the bull he'd drawn and couldn't regain it, landing in the dirt. Although he had been second in the short go, he ended up winning the event. One event into the season, he was in first place, precisely where he needed to be. He collected his check and texted both his mom and Sophia that he was on his way back. But as he started the long drive home, his head still throbbing, he wondered why he honestly didn't care about the points at all.
"You look terrible," Sophia said. "Are you okay?"
Luke tried to force a reassuring grin. After collapsing into bed around 3 a.m., he'd awakened after 11, his head and body a chorus of pain. Automatically, he'd reached for the painkillers and swallowed several before staggering to the shower, where he'd let the hot spray seep into his bruised and knotted muscles.
"I'm fine," he said. "It was a long drive, and ever since I got up, I've been working on repairing some broken fencing."
"Are you sure?"
Sophia's concern reflected her skepticism at his reassurances. Ever since she had arrived at the ranch that afternoon, she'd been scrutinizing him like an anxious mother hen.
"You're acting like you're coming down with something."
"Just tired is all. It's been a long couple of days."
"I know. But you won, huh?"
"Yeah,"
he said.
"I won."
"That's good. For the ranch, I mean."
Sophia wrinkled her forehead.
"Yeah,"
he repeated, sounding almost numb.
"It's good for the ranch."
24. Sophia.
Luke was off again. Not like last weekend, but something definitely wasn't right with him. And it wasn't just exhaustion, either. He was pale, his skin tone almost white, and though he'd denied it, she knew that he was in a lot more pain than usual. Sometimes, when he'd made a quick, unexpected movement, she'd noticed he'd wince or draw a sharp breath. Dinner with his mom had been a stilted affair. Though Linda was happy to see her, Luke had stayed outside by the grill while she and Linda chatted the whole time, almost as if he were trying to avoid them. At the table, the conversation had been notable for all the subjects they studiously avoided. Luke didn't talk about his obvious pain, his mom asked nothing about the rodeo, and Sophia refused to mention Marcia or Brian or how awful the week had been at the house. And it had been awful. One of the worst weeks ever. As soon as they returned to Luke's, he made straight for the bedroom. She heard him tap out some pills from one bottle, then another, then followed him as he walked to the kitchen, where he swallowed what she guessed was a handful of pills with a glass of water.
To her alarm, he leaned forward, resting both hands on the edge of the counter. His head hung low.
How bad is it?
She whispered, her hands on his back.
Your headache, I mean.
He drew a couple of long breaths before answering.
I'm okay, he said.
Obviously you're not, she said. How much did you take?
A couple of each, he admitted.
But I saw you take some before dinner.
It wasn't enough, obviously.
If it's that bad, you should have gone to the doctor.
There's no reason, he said in a dull voice. I already know what's wrong.
What's wrong?
I have a concussion.
She blinked.
How? Did you hit your head when you jumped off the bull?
No, he said. I landed wrong in practice a couple of weeks ago.
A couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, he admitted. And I made the mistake of practicing again too soon.
You mean your head's been hurting for 2 weeks?
Sophia tried to keep the rising panic out of her voice.
Not like this. Riding yesterday aggravated it again.
Why would you ride then if you have what sounds like a concussion?
He kept his focus on the floor.
I didn't have a choice.
Of course you had a choice. And that was a stupid thing to do. Come on, let's bring you to the emergency room.
No,
he said.
Why not? She said, bewildered. I'll drive. You need to see a doctor.
I've had headaches like this before, and I know what a doctor's going to tell me. He's going to tell me to take some time off, and I can't do that.
You mean you're going to ride again next weekend?
I have to.
Sophia tried and failed to understand what he was saying.
Is that why your mom has been so mad at you? Because you're acting like an idiot?
He didn't answer right away. Instead, he sighed.
She doesn't even know about it.
You didn't tell her? Why wouldn't you tell her?
Because I don't want her to know. She'd just end up worrying.
She shook her head.
I just don't understand why you would continue to ride when you know it's going to make your concussion worse. It's dangerous.
I'm past worrying about it, he said.
What do you mean by that?
Luke slowly pushed himself upright and turned to face her with an expression of resignation, something akin to an apology.
Because, he finally said, even before the concussion, I was never supposed to ride again.
She wasn't sure she'd heard him right, and she blinked. You're not supposed to ride at all? Ever?
According to the doctors, I'm taking a massive risk every single time.
Because?
Big ugly critter, he said. I didn't just get knocked out and dragged around. I told you he trampled me, but I didn't tell you that he fractured my skull, back near the brainstem. There's a small metal plate there now, but if I land wrong, it's not going to be enough to protect me.
As he spoke in a monotone, Sophia felt a chill spread through her body at his words.
He couldn't be serious. Are you saying that you could die?
She didn't wait for an answer, feeling panic flood her system as she registered the truth.
That's what you're saying, isn't it? That you'll die? And you didn't tell me about this? How could you not tell me?
It all clicked into place, the pieces fitting together. Why he'd wanted to see the bull on their first night together. Why his mom was so angry with him. His tense preoccupation before the start of the season.
Well, that's it then, she went on, trying to suppress the terror in her voice. You're not riding anymore, okay? You're done. As of now, you're retired again.
Again, he said nothing, but she could see in his face that she wasn't getting through. She moved in and encircled him with her arms, squeezing in desperation. She could feel his heart beating, could feel the strong muscles in his chest.
I don't want you to do this. You can't do this, okay? Please tell me that you're finished with all this. We'll figure some other way to save the ranch, okay?
There is no other way.
There's always another way.
No,
he said.
There isn't.
Luke, I know the ranch is important, but it's not more important than your life. You know that, right? You'll start over. You'll get another ranch, or you'll work on a ranch.
I don't need the ranch, he broke in. I'm doing this for my mom.
She pushed away from him, feeling a swell of anger.
But she doesn't want you to do this either. Because she knows it's wrong. She knows how stupid it is. Because you're her son.
I'm doing it for her.
No, you're not, Sophia interrupted. You're doing it so that you won't have to feel guilty.
You think you're being noble, but you're really being selfish. This is the most selfish thing—
She broke off, her chest heaving.
Sophia—
Don't touch me, she cried. You're going to hurt me, too.